which means this first presentation may go an hour and 10 minutes, hour and a quarter, or what have you. And if anybody has to run the hour, get up and go, that's okay, do go. My name is Walt Wandgren. This is the beginning of four discussions or lectures about Advent based upon the texts for Series A, which mostly will come from Matthew. That's the formal beginning. Okay. I'm going to take on a topic that is just fraught with feeling. And if you notice, everyone except one of those subtitles has the word hell in it. I would like to tell you right at the beginning that what my procedure will be this morning is to say something about what the church has done with that concept at number one there, what we will call one level only, and that it has sometimes, but it has not always, moved beyond that very harsh and very unthinking, sometimes very cold, assumption of what the hereafter has to do with divisions of the peoples. So my hope at this point is not only to establish or remind you of things that you may have heard, but then using Matthew and several other things to go beyond that, and perhaps to bring it to a level that fits our understanding today without at the same time doing violence to the revelations that we have. That's my hope. And therefore, even all the way to the end, when we begin to realize that some of the things that appear call the whole church into question and call it into question for its abuse of this concept, I would hope that you'd hang with me and understand that we're going to start at a point and then we're going to move and move and move beyond that point much as possible. Let me start with a prayer. Almighty God, I am indeed unworthy of the office and the ministry in which I am to make known your glory and to nurture and serve these people. But because you have appointed me to be a pastor and a teacher, and because the people are in need of the teachings and the instructions, be thou my helper and let your holy angels attend me. Then if you are pleased to accomplish anything through me or this study or lecture, let it be unto your glory, not to mine or to the glory of any people. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, Shepherd and Bishop of our souls, send your Holy Spirit to work with me and with us, to will and to do through thy divine strength, according to thy good pleasure. Amen. It's Advent. And traditionally, Advent is a time, we didn't mention this when we talked about the introductions before, but it's good to mention this now. Advent was the community recognizing that the church doesn't do so good, that we don't do so good, that come Christmas, it isn't all joy, that there's brokenness in human society, and that some of that brokenness is our fault, others' fault. That fault is involved. And so here comes one season of the church year when patiently, we hope with clear eyes, without a maudlin sentimentality or a mere breastfeeding, we say, yeah, we've got to acknowledge that. And what does that mean? Now that will be intermixed, as I said the other night, with the sweet words and the blessed words of Matthew in this Matthew's chapter 1 and the birth of Jesus. And in all Advents, there is that expectation, that joyful, breathless expectation of the coming of the hero, the coming of Jesus. This is a heavier Advent than usual, though. And as I said the other night, my tendency would be to avoid some of this stuff. It really, truly would be. Which, in fact, I'm going to suggest the church has done lately. It has essentially avoided some of the material that we're presenting here because it got embarrassed by it. What it got embarrassed by, however, I think was its own fault. Some of its narrow presentations. And instead of saying, is there a depth here? Can we go farther with this whole idea of the divisions at the final advent? Watch out, time's demise, the end of time is coming. Rather than go deeper sometimes, it's simply withdrawn this whole issue and doesn't like to talk about it. Doesn't like to talk about things that will make people distressed or uncomfortable. Here are certain presumptions that stand behind our understanding of human behavior, God's response, and the whole issue that devolves into consequences. I'll just lay them out for you, and they're very simple. Human behavior is good or bad. It has the capacity to be both. It's not much talked about now, especially when we enter into a sort of subjectivism where it's neither good nor bad, and it may be worked out. It may be the individual's choices and so forth. There are a lot of ways of saying it, but the approach throughout Christianity and throughout other religions generally, even those that want to talk necessarily about the physical behaviors, Buddhism, for example, nevertheless do define a goodness or a badness with consequences for the individual. Good or bad? That the goodness and the badness has consequences on at least three levels. It has consequences for those we hurt. And immediately when we get to that point, all of a sudden we realize, oh yeah, there is good and bad. I have been hurt. People have hurt me. So there's bad behaviors there. So it has immediate consequences because bad behavior, it's almost never private. I would love to tell you a Garrison Keillor story at this moment, but I don't have time. Oh. I know, I shouldn't even have said that. I will tell it to you when I have time sometimes. And the whole point behind it is the recognition that even what I think I do in private, because of the spiritual union of the whole world, affects others, affects my children, and so forth. That's another piece of it, that the world is not merely material, but that it enjoys a spiritual union among us. That nuns bent down in private, in monasteries, delivering their whole souls for the prayer of the world, affect the world. That when the Lakota dance, the Indian sun dance, and they stand in the center of the circle, as I've seen them do, and weep prayers, and suffer prayers for the sake of their children, no, for the sake of all children, that all children should not fall into abuses or harm or drugs or alcohol. This is the point. Within the enjoyment of a spiritual world, those prayers have effect. They have effect. That's one of the spin-offs of this. Okay, so there's good and bad behavior. Behavior has consequence immediately. It has consequence over a period of time within time itself because it has a solo emerging consequence both for the individual, as we will see here, who does bad behavior, as well as for the corporate, for all people. Because there's a kind of a presumption in the Old Testament particularly that as the kings or as others behave badly, whole nations can suffer that bad behavior. Or let's put it into modern terms, as those who are in power behave badly, their power pumps up that bad behavior, and whole nations and whole families and whole groups or whole strata of society and suffer that bad behavior. But then there's this third consequence, and that is that something of that bad behavior, unless something else intervenes, may linger past this time into the non-time to come. I should talk at some point here about Sally McFay. Has anyone here read The Body of God? No? Good. I'll make some reference to it then and introduce you to it a little bit as we go. Just very quickly here, what I'm telling you may sound very old, but Sally, in this book, The Body of God, suggests that the creation story, which is in existence right now, beginning with the Big Bang, if you will, suggests a neat story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So there's this presumption of an end, even yet today. That goodness and badness, number three, and if you're writing this all down, maybe no. That we don't stumble into these things, but there is the capacity to find out what is good and what is bad. That goodness and badness may be discovered in several ways, but the presumption is that good behavior is the will of God, Torah. Torah is the blessed will of God delivered unto the people, unto a people. Not just flat Torah, not just the books of the Bible, but you'll notice that from the very beginning on, it's Torah interpreted, reinterpreted. There's the Mishnah, there's the Talmud, and so it isn't just whack like that. By the way, the Old Testament is much more gentle and much more kind in certain ways than I was raised to believe when St. Paul simply whacks the law and says the law is bad. Well, there was this deep love of the mind of God and the presence of God, which when we behaved according to the law, became the presence of God among the people. Marvelous thought. And it wasn't just harsh. There was all kinds of gentle reapplication, which the rabbis have done, the Hasidim, down through the ages. Are you with me so far? Yeah, I'm saying, taking long. I thought these are so simple. I just whip through them. And that goodness is in God somehow. And goodness and godness are much the same. Badness is not in God. A fundamental way of saying that is that when human beings turn away from God, that becomes badness. In the Old Testament, it uses language of wrath and anger. In the New Testament, it becomes something different. It becomes alienation and separation. That when we are not with that blessed mind of the Creator, then we become something anti-creational. Okay, so far? Yeah? Okay. That we may choose good and bad, by the way. Although I know we've been taught that all of our, you know, we're bound up in sin so much that our sinfulness completely directs us, and all we do is as, what was that? Filthy rags. Nevertheless, there was always the presumption that we could choose good and bad. That there is this capacity for choosing, or, you know, what is this whole issue of the consequences? And this, by the way, is just a, it's a wonderful sense of Judaism, that choice is there. And even if we do choose the bad, what is available? Atonement. That there is always this at-one-ment again between the people and God. But that if one persists in choosing the bad, the opposite of at-one-ment comes to be. In the Old Testament, they had this concept of impurity, which needed an expiation. That's why the wrath of God became such a powerful image for them. Now, we're not talking so much about the impurity, but that if we persist in the choices that are bad, then they are our choices. They elevate us to a small realm, and they divide our own realm, our little power, our little fiefdom, and they divide us from God. Now, those things obtain, they stand. But let's start here now. Oh, I have to tell you, when I was a kid, I don't think this is off the point. When I was a kid, I would tremble when the pastor started reading stuff like we have. Oh, and I made a plan. This is the let me find the text so that we have before us, Matthew 24, verse 30. This is the gospel lesson for the first Sunday in Advent. Matthew, I should mark all these things, 24. There we go, starting at verse 36. Context, this comes in three chapters, 23, 24, and 25, when Jesus is talking about the end. 23 has all the woes, this heavy, heavy woes which are upon the scribes and the Pharisees, this hypocrisy, people who abuse the power that has been granted unto them and make it their power and not power for blessing or 24 begins when the disciples say unto Jesus, okay, what are the signs of the end? How will we know when it comes? And 25 then continues with the parables of the signs of the end. That is to say, it'll be like the bridegroom is coming, and there are those five who have lamps, and there are those five who are unprepared and don't have lamps, and so forth. But we're in the middle of that, and these are the verses we're looking at. Verse 36. But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. In those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. So, you know, just going along, life is life. Until the day Noah entered the ark. Wham! You can remember that, and shut the door. Boom! That's how it is in there. And shut the door. Boom! That always struck me as an ineluctable and powerful symbol. Oh. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. This is the new RSV. Then two of them will be in the field, and one will be taken, and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, and one will be taken, one will be left. I mean, if we're going to talk about the division at the end of time, that's what we have here. This is what Jesus is talking about. One is snatched away, and one is left. Whether to good or to bad, I don't know. Keep awake, therefore. Oh, so here I am, the kid, about 6, 7, 8, sitting in church, and it's a very kind pastor, and he's reading these things, and I know he isn't, well, maybe he is, somewhere, but he wasn't out to terrified me.
Keep awake, therefore. You do not know what day your lord is coming. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake, would not have let his house be broken into. That's what my plan was. I'm going to be awake. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. The end of that chapter, verse 51, those who are unprepared drink to the drunkards, the master and the slave. Verse 51, it says here, cut them to pieces, cast into outer darkness, cut them off, harsh language, and put him, this one, cut with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping, oh, and gnashing of teeth. Didn't that scare you, that image? Oh, I could just see the tears and gnashing of teeth. I never heard anyone gnash, grind, but gnash. Oh, so, you know, and then it talks about the moon, and in that same chapter, immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heaven, and then this is before the text, actually. I'm still reading from the same chapter. I began at verse 29. The sign of the Son of the Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He will send out his angels with a trumpet call, and they will gather the elect from the four winds, from every end of heaven to the other. So, I had a plan. Bethlehem Lutheran Church, the place where I would be confirmed. Every time I heard those verses, the first thing is I would look at the front of the church with its altar, which looked to me like a great tongue. And its reredos, that Byzantine, you know, beautiful interweaving reredos behind it. And its cross and its candles. And I would think that was like the open mouth of the gates of hell. I thought it was it could suddenly become the jaws of hell. You know, gates of hell. And so my plan was, I always sat on the left-hand side, which is the east side of our church, where there was a little crack in the window, in stained glass window. I took seriously this phrase, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. Little advance warning. I watched for the clouds. Now, on other Sundays and so forth, I wouldn't think, but I watched those clouds, and my plan was, as soon as I saw a strange cloud hit the earth, I was going under the pew. I was going to go under the pew, back six pews, I would pop up, go down the steps, and hide in the boiler room. And then Jesus could come with all the clouds of glory and bring all these elect from the four corners of the earth, plus all the damned, you know, they would rise up too. And I figured that was at least 100,000 people. And in all that jumble, Jesus wouldn't miss one little kid. That was my plan. Because this is what we were offered. This level of hell. What I'm going to do is take all of this from Matthew. But this is only one level, let me keep saying to you. This is what. That hell was a fire. Actually, this is throughout the synoptics. It's not in Johannine literature, but it is in the synoptics, and it's in other intertestamental literature. That hell was a fire. That it was for the wicked. Matthew, I put up some verses here you can look at later on, but in Matthew 5:22, this is the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus is talking about this this relationship we have with other people. Whether we hate them, what does that do? And finally, if we would call them fool, then we are liable of the Gehenna, the hell of fire. Same thing here. It talks about if you have a bad eye, pluck it out and throw it away. Better to get rid of a bad eye than to go wickedly into the fires forever. It was for the wicked. It is a punishment which is eternal. Matthew chapter 25, right after our verse here. In twice, those who did not recognize Jesus, did not serve the poor, the hungry, and so forth and so on. Remember, this is behavior with its consequence, according to this. We'll enter into eternal Gehenna, eternal fires. That it's pre-existent, because it's, and again in Matthew it says it was there from the beginning of time, waiting. And all of you, I'm sure, maybe I'm raising some history in your own minds, if this is all that you are able to receive or hear when you were young. And here's a slight distinction, that body and soul will be joined together to be cast into hell. Matthew speaks of hell as that which takes both body and soul. eternally. Luke is a little bit different. This is instructive to notice the differences. Luke talks about hell as that which receives the soul immediately upon death. Matthew has it, as we are talking here, at time's demise, at the end of time. Luke talks about it coming immediately when an individual dies and the soul goes into it. It's nice to notice a little difference in there. It's a little crack. Well, it's a good one. I mean, it's a crack we can work with. It's a legitimate crack. When we start seeing that people are making, that the Gospels themselves are beginning to make interpretation of it. I'm not going to go much farther with that, but you see, all of this has a sort of an apocalyptic feeling, and it doesn't just appear in Matthew. It really was developed already in the intertestamental period, right? You know what I mean by that. After our last, what we call our last book of the Old Testament, there's the period of about 200 or 300 years before Christ comes, when a whole concept of apocalypse rises up. In the Old Testament, the day of the Lord began as a time when God would come, the Messiah of God, the anointed of God, the King of God, as it were, would come and put the whole real earth under the rule of God, as they felt it had been once. Well, in the years of Roman rule, and before that Persian rule, they realized that that probably was never going to happen. So the day of the Lord became spiritualized. It became spiritualized. Now they said it wouldn't happen within time. They began to get this sense that there would be an end of this age, an end of this time. And the day of the Lord now was when Messiah would come and change all things and rule. At their sense of the changing of all things, they had to deal with the issues of what about the people who were good or bad, who were in or out, who were the Jews or who were not the Jews, who were part of the holy people and who were not, what would happen? Well, at first, they only talked about those who would enter into a sort of paradisiacal relationship with God. They didn't talk, the dead would be dead forever. But then they began to raise this notion, no, all flesh can continue forever, therefore what will happen with the dead? Well, they'll go to hell. So this notion arose before Matthew came. Are you with me? Still? You'll stop me when you're not. I mean, in terms of understanding. All right. So this is what we find in Matthew. This is what we find in the synoptics, essentially, that it is a fire and these things follow. When I was taught that, I was granted at least this much, that gentle and persuasive teachers would say, yes, but that's a figure. It's a way of speaking about things that we don't fully understand. No, it will not necessarily be a fire where you cook. Although I must tell you, that's what they were thinking then. They were thinking of cooking in fires. And that's why it persisted throughout the ages, through the Middle Ages and so forth and so on. But we were said, figure. I have to tell you though, and maybe your experience is better than mine, what sort of figure that was, something that I might actually hook onto and imagine apart from fires, was not granted me. And so I was left in a kind of a swimming oblivion for a while. But look what we have even in this text. This is a new word. Jesus refers to Noah. Just some flat teaching for you here, but it's important. Do you know that Jesus, in all of the history of the scriptures, is the first one who ever uses Noah as a paradigm or an archetype for anything? The prophets of the Old Testament always refer within the backward, in the context of their covenant relationship with God. They will go far back as Abraham, where God makes a covenant with their ancestor Abraham. They will go back, medium back, as far as the Exodus, where God makes a covenant with the peoples. They'll go back even a little lesser, 1,000 years, to the time when God makes a special covenant with David. The prophets will look at all of these, but they don't go back to that first covenant. It was a covenant with Noah. Jesus is the first one. Now this ought to suddenly make us suck in a little air and say, ah, what's here that has not been taught us all along? What's involved? And I must tell you, some of what's involved ups the ante and makes it even more terrible. It's a paradox, because also comes with it a deeper understanding of what this time's demise might be if we can compare it to the flood. Nobody ever did that before. By the way, and it's almost, you know that there are people who interpret the Bible right now and suggest that there are some things that Jesus surely said and that there are some things that maybe others added. This is something that Jesus surely said.
because this figure of Noah appears both in the Synoptics and in Johannine, which are different traditions. They have slightly different interpretation. In John, Jesus says, you all are looking for a sign, but you will not have any other sign besides Noah, who was 3 days in the belly of the whale. So you see there's a different application there. But nevertheless, Jesus, the first one, refers to Noah and the flood. And so what is that? Well, here's the heavy part. Jesus now makes this end time for everybody. As in the flood, it's all people. There's no distinction now about covenant. It's not just the Jews. It's everybody. That means us. So tremble. I mean, you could have said, you know, that's a little story over here for the Jews that they suffer hell. No. It's everybody. Jesus suddenly makes it that way. Nobody seems to bat from that. But here come a series of paradoxes when you make this parallel to Noah. One is, just as Jesus says, it is sudden. Yes, the end will be sudden. Yes, you must watch out. But it's not without signs. No, you can't pluck the minute. No, you can't pluck the day. No, you can't pluck the whatever. But it is not without signs. Now, I've read this purposely to you before. Verse 30 and 24th chapter. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Matthew picks up on this and is not unconscious. The signs themselves may be very, here they're granted as frightful signs, but they may nevertheless be very good signs. That is to say that someone is asked to do an impossible, no, to do a paradoxical, to do a, what should I say, a strange thing, build a boat in dry land? A conundrum. People are acting as conundrums. I want to take a little time with this sign because this is really important. St. Paul talks about this marvelous, marvelous paradox of how we live. Being poor but acting as if we're rich. Being bound but acting as if we're free. Suffering but remaining joyful. That whole sequence is in 2 Corinthians. There go among us these people who just addle the brains of the world, but become shining signs to those who begin to realize that something else is going on here. Holden Village? Well, if you really truly in the midst of hard work and labor and accusation and trouble, if you really truly remain a community in spite of things, and there's a genuine welcoming joy here, in spite of things, it's the in spite of that becomes the sign. That's building boats where there is no water. Do you follow what I'm saying? The signs can exist. And the more they exist, the closer is this remarkable moment of, this terrible moment of the flood. No, you don't know the time. You don't. But what does that mean? All of a sudden, this watch out doesn't just mean run away, say, hills fall on us. All of a sudden, it means watch. Watch out. Watch around you. It's coming, but there are things you can see that are simply inexplicable by the world standards. The world with its logic of selfness and economy and whatever. You'll run into these strange little oddities. And they're not bright. You know, no one shines lights on them. They just go about their business in joyful silence. Well, now I'm taking too long, but the concept of the martyrs in the beginning is exactly that. They were part of these signs. That is to say that they would be beaten and killed, but did so joyfully. That's impossible to accept. And did so worse than joyfully, and did so without blaming. I will tell you a story when we preach on Sunday, when I preach. I'm going to bring a story home. It happened here at Holden Village a while back. I'm going to tell you a story of a man, of an African, who just blew me away because all that he had suffered did not produce in him blame, but love and a call, a vocation. He is for me a sign. The man's building a boat of joy where there's only the dryness of accusation and pain. You follow me? All right, it's sudden, but it's not without signs. And this is even, it's chaos. Let's go back to the flood.
I think, by the way, this is one of the reasons it is such a touchy thing that it was an archetype not drawn upon by the Old Testament or the prophets. Do you remember the definition of the flood? You remember how it said that the windows of heaven were opened up? Remember that? I used to think that was just an image for heavy rain. Not so. Do you remember how it said that the floods of the deep burst up in fountains? I thought that was just an image for geysers. Not so. In order to understand that language of the flood, go back to the creation. In the creation, it says God divided the waters above from the waters below with a firmament, which was understood as a division, a hard blue dome, bong, 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 as a protective area. The Greeks would say God made space in which human beings could dwell. The Hebrews said God fought chaos back. That's what wild waters are in Hebrew understanding. They're chaos. There's no order. I mean, just imagine for yourself white water rafting when the whole world is the white water. And there's nowhere to go, and there's neither future nor past. There's just white water. And it's not just even down, it's up and down. Imagine that you're caught on a wadi, in other words. This is where I think the image comes from. This dry riverbed, when suddenly up river, the rains come, and this comes like a wall. We've seen that on television. Okay, that's why for the Hebrews, the image of chaos is this water. So what is God doing in the flood? It's not just a heavy rain. It's chaos come again. If you could imagine this being the space in which human beings live, it's this. So here comes a paradox. Jesus refers to the end as the waters, the flood, the deluge coming. And so on the one hand, it is chaos come again. It is the end of this world as we know it, sort of. I'd like to get back to that one day and talk about that again. But it is with a focus in the center and a... Because it isn't just the rains now. Look what's coming with the rain. Jesus. In the midst of chaos, this remarkable paradox is the focus for chaos, which is not chaos anymore. Is one who is coming in the center of it all. And so all of a sudden you realize that if we're talking about the end as a chaos, it's all of it like a whirlpool that brings us to God, to Jesus. To that figure of God. Because this is the descent of the Son of Man. So it's not just water coming down or chaos. There's a lump in it. There's a thing there. There's a living thing. It's got a face, calls, speaks. And according to John, what it says is, when it speaks, what it says is, Maya, calls us by name. Calls us by name. And here's another thing I've got to add. The confluence of God. And this is Matthea. So as all these waters come together and we see the Son of Man, as Jesus refers to himself, come down. But you know what else Matthew has been saying? Sometimes I think maybe I'm rushing too fast. We should just pause and say, ah. Well, say ah to this. In the 25th chapter, you remember, I made reference to it, Jesus gives this final parable that coming on the clouds of glory, says unto those who fed the poor, and I mean fed the hungry, took care of the poor, clothed, visited the sick, went to the prisons, says, come, you did it to me. Come to me, you did it to me. Now notice that paradox. We're going to play paradox all along. So here is Jesus standing here and saying, come to me because I was over here and you did it to me. I'm both places. Now this is the remarkable moment of a seeming chaos, which is not chaos at all. Chaos at all. I was in both places. I was behind you saying, do it. And I was in front of you saying, thank you. Are you following? Oh, it's more than that. So, but let's take our image again. So here comes the Son of Man with the waters and the chaos down to meet all that the Son of Man was, all that Jesus was in the behavior of human beings below. So this is a confluence, but there's a third. And that's Matthew's final logism, the word of Jesus. The very end of the book, which I told you the other night, matches up with the first. In chapter 1, the angel says, call that kid Emmanuel, God with us. And in the final verse of the final chapter, Jesus says, and I will be with you always, even to the end of the world. So So we've got a third dimension. From above comes the descending Son of Man. Below is the Jesus whom we served and who took up therefore residence in our behavior. With us, side by side with us, helping us in the baptism and the mission, carrying the word around, is the Jesus, the Emmanuel, who is with us until the end. Now there is a triple confluence. Almost impossible to understand, but suddenly this concept of a chaos means it's the chaos of the coming together of God into a union, into a single union, and we're caught into it. And of course that's going to seem at first chaotic, because all that we took our bearings by in this world are for a moment lost. With me? And I've got to add this. There is one other use of Noah in the New Testament, and it's fairly clear that it was a doctrine that was taught relatively early and then maintained. In 1 Peter chapter 3, speaking even about a time like this time, the writer says, well, you know, it was like in the days of Noah when 8 people were saved. 8 people were saved, he said, and Peter says, and this is a figure of baptism, for water now saves us, not as a washing, I mean, not as a scrubbing, but rather as an appeal unto God for clear conscience through Jesus Christ, atonement. When this figure is used in Jesus' mouth, you've got to hear a hint in the background of this salvation quality of baptism as it was taught in the early church as well. And so I'll say my final word at this point. All the world will be baptized. There is a cleansing of things. Flood, which is destruction, can also be flood, which is cleansing. And not just 8 people, but all then ride that flood, ride that waters in what became throughout the ages the ship of hope, the boat. All right, that's what's behind Jesus' new word. Now I've got to go fast and even more. All right, what sort of figure is this business of fire? What is behind that? To answer what sort of figure is it, ask what sort of act is it? This Gehenna thing, this hell. I'm going to take a shift here if you're with me. If you're dozing, don't blame me. Blame Daniel. Yep. He talked all that. I couldn't doze last night. I couldn't get my sleep in the way he talks. I mean, I had to listen to him. Besides, he's good. He's loud. I told him that I saw his picture on the board in outside of the dining hall there, you know, where all of your pictures are. And it says what you do. And I looked underneath his name and I was sure it said opinions. Operations is what it says, but I think opinions is his primary. You know that the word for hell in Latin, and actually Latin, Gehenna is Greek, Latin is Gehenna. You know that that has a history, don't you? Let's go back to here. What I didn't often hear was the history behind the whole concept of fire and hell. Take some steps backward with me first. Take steps backward even before the year 1000, when David took Jerusalem as his own city, and the city therefore which would become the seat of his government. It was a Canaanite city. Here's the city. Here is Moriah, which becomes the Temple Mount later on, and the hill south of it, which becomes the King or the Royal Hill. Here is a valley, a very shallow valley, which goes into a deeper one here. And then it goes into a nice one here. This is called the Kidron Valley. Later on, Jesus will cross the Kidron to go up to the Mount of Olives. You're all with me? It's this valley south of Jerusalem, immediately south and southwest of the city, which is important for us. It was ultimately called by the Israelites and the Jews the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom, H-I-N-N-O-N, or H-I-N-N-O-M, the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. What's important about that valley? When this was a Canaanite city, that's the place where they sacrificed to 2 gods, Baal and Moloch, Moloch, M-O-L-E-C-H. There are various spellings for that. Now, here's the curious thing. You know, throughout the whole Old Testament, there's this warning about moving from God to other gods.
in this valley, the sacrifice took on a very specific act. I mean, not only did they have the high places and the incenses and the prayers and the sacrifices, but they had, please, so important for you to know this history because of how it comes, they sacrificed children. It was here unto Moloch that the rulers of the city, it was particularly those who were in power, and I want to say this now so you get it from the beginning, but it's a result of interpretation, who felt that their power was threatened, would turn unto this chthonic god, this death god, this god of the underworld, this god of death, Moloch. And they would sacrifice their own children. It doesn't seem to have been a regular thing. It doesn't seem to have been a regular ritual, best we can understand. But it came at certain moments. Not always, but sometimes when the city itself was threatened, therefore war. But not always. Sometimes it was simply because the king felt himself, internal, external, to be threatened. And this was an act of divination. This is a seeking after knowledge, and it was a redress of power. Please follow all this, and then you'll understand the horribleness of what Gehenna becomes in the minds of the people. Well, when David took over, we don't hear of David doing that. But I won't turn to it because of the shortness of time. But King Ahaz, who ruled in the early period of Isaiah's prophecy, who was terrified because the Assyrians are squashing the northern kingdom, King Ahaz, it said, passed his children through the fire in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. And that phrase, passed through, that's not just a eulogy or a eulogism. What am I looking for?
Euphemism.
Euphemism, thank you. It means exactly that. It means that for the children to enter into the underworld, they passed through fire. Fire was the burning of them, and they would enter into the underworld there with Moloch to empower the parent who sent them through to redress and empower. Let's just stick with that word. That they might not lose power and that they might gain knowledge. King Ahaz is said to have passed his children through the fire in that place. And he's not the only one. Manasseh, after the demise of the northern kingdom, when he himself was becoming terribly afraid that elements of the north, as well as elements of Damascus and others, were going to team up against him, he took a kid, likely a son, and he passed his son through fire into this underworld place in order to empower himself. This is perceived of as a horror. So horrible is it that Jeremiah takes that act and expands it into something which becomes an image that the people never forget thereafter. Jeremiah 7, I have it up here if you want to come later on and check these out. Jeremiah 7, 27 to 34. Listen. So you shall speak all these words to them. By the way, you know that Jeremiah prophesies just before the exile, just before Judah, the southern kingdom itself, is carried away. But they will not listen to you. You shall call to them, but they will not answer you. You shall say to them, this is the nation that did not obey the voice of the Lord their God and did not accept discipline. Truth has perished. It is cut off from their lips. Just keep that in mind when we talk about corporate consequences. You know, what happens? What happens when whole nations or whole churches or whole bodies, organisms, organizations of power cease the good and the gentle and the loving behavior and begin to act for the power of the self? Remember what this figure means. The figure of hell is the result of individuals empowering and sacrificing others to the self-empowerment. Well, I have to skip ahead of your two verse if you're following me or not. Verse 31. And they go on building the high place of Topheth. Oh, I have to tell you. In the valley of the sons of Hinnom, which I should tell you right now, is what's back of that word Gehenna. Geh means valley. And it's shortened. It becomes the valley of, not Bar, not the sons of, but merely the valley of Hinnom. Gehenna. Gehenna. This is the place we're talking. Gehenna. Gehenna. What's going to happen here? And they go on building the high places of Topheth, which is the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in fire.
which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. Therefore, so you get that sense of this division of the good and evil and where God's mind is. Therefore, the days are surely coming, says the Lord, when it will no more be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth until there is no more room. The corpses of this people will be food for the birds of the air and for the animals of the earth, and no one will frighten them away, and so forth. It'll bring Jerusalem to a waste. So now there are some terrible associations with that valley. Fire. You see that now. Fire is associated with that valley. And the burning of children and the turning away from God is all associated with that valley. Isaiah makes an ironic statement too, which I want to come to again a little bit later, where his irony says that valley is also prepared for Moloch. That is to say, those who would use the valley unto their own benefit ultimately will enter that valley unto their own peril. It's a remarkable irony. Now, as I told you, during the intertestamental period, when this apocalyptic concept rose up, they really thought of that place, that horrible place that Jeremiah literally pointed at. Jeremiah came one day with a beautiful pot, a beautiful, delicate pot that if you break it, you cannot fix it. God told Jeremiah to do this and bring the elders of the city, which he did. And while he was talking, he said, look at yourselves. Look at yourselves standing right there above Topheth and Gehenna. He said, this is what God is going to do to you. And the thing burst right down there. And they're seeing. Now they turned away, but when all those people in that same generation went into exile, they remembered, that's the consequence, that burning. They thought of that place as a powerful symbol or a reality, you know, where one enters into this horrible place of Moloch, the horrible place of the dead through fire. And they thought of it as that place we do not, we should not, we don't want to go anymore. Are you with me? Then, when the apocalyptic notions rose up after they returned, then they saw this as the place where anyone who would turn from God, and although it's not said, I add this because it's implied, where anyone who arrogates power unto him or herself, or any corporate being, nations, governments, churches, arrogate power unto themselves at the sacrifice of others, are going to go. Now you understand what the hell of fire means. That's the figure that I didn't get. It's something that one chooses for oneself when one goes after another God, when one thinks only to send children through the fire. The irony is, but you pass through that fire too. I'm going to take one more step for you so that I can translate it now into something of what we have today. But are you with me so far? Let me just pause at a remarkable irony. And I don't think this irony should be lost. So what the powerful people in those days did with their children for their own private salvation, who did with a child for the salvation of the world? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish. The word is perish. Should not be cut off. Should not be isolated. Should not die, but have everlasting life. It's a remarkable irony. God looks down on the horrors of humanity and says, okay, all right, I'll take that and I'll change it. I'll change it into something that saves humanity. All right, so we take a step. Now that you understand what this stands for, that is the empowerment of self at the sacrifice of another, how can we apply that today? Now I call it the hill of self. And Gehenna, that valley, concept of fires, I don't have to go anywhere else but here. And what I want to argue now, and this is perhaps the most important thing I want to offer you, is that for me in the past, according to Dostoevsky, for people in general, love which continues to love me becomes the fire that burns me. Let me tell you my story first, and as I have time, I'll tell you Dostoevsky. I used to live in Edmonton, Canada. Oldest of seven children. My dad was the president of Concordia College. Very important fellow.
what he said didn't just ring in our household, but it rang throughout the whole college, which to me was almost a universe. Get it? In those days, my father, who is a man by nature gentle, except when he enters into this business of dispensing law, Torah, he wore dark rimmed glasses, these heavy dark rimmed glasses, and he had dark hair, which swept back with a big curl in front. And he had these eyebrows, which mine are trying to affect right now, which came up like this. He would always sit there and twirl his eyebrows so that they looked to me like raven's wings coming off his brow. He had a very strong voice. You can hear it in me. He had a strong voice that would echo, and every once in a while he would use that voice. And I know it was to good effect. We used to play in the hockey rink in spring and summer. Hockey rink was a good place to play football. Perfect round, right? Has a wall around it like that. Even some of the powder that they used to put the lines in the ice is still there after the ice melts. Perfect. The only problem with a hockey rink, when you want to start play, oh, and we ran in sock feet. I mean, Nike didn't exist. This is back in the 50s. And we thought we were fleetest in sock feet. The trouble was is that at the end of the winter, when finally the ground was dry, it had little stones on it. And so we always spent time picking up the stones, you know, in order to play on there. So there would be 3, 4, 5, 6 of us out there, Randy and Feller and my brother Paul and me and others, and we just fling the stones out. Now, I never was particularly athletic, which was to my advantage and disadvantage. Disadvantage when we played, advantage when I threw stones out. I just, as a matter of course, pick a stone up and wing it up at the lights. Hockey rink had these big incandescent lights, right? That would shine down on the rink in winter. And I just whoop and missed. I always missed. I'm not a good shot. But I whoop and missed. And I remember one day I picked it up and hooped and I heard, whoa! That's that voice I'm telling you about. Here comes my father. And in those, I mean, he wore complete black. He wore a clerical collar. He's got these black eyebrows, you know, like raven's wings. Wally, what are you doing?
Nothing.
You are throwing stones at the bulbs, he said.
Well,
yes. Why? I always miss, Dad. I always miss. It's just fun. And he said, he came to the edge of that, and he looked over at his eyebrows, and he said, don't you do that again. He said, those bulbs are 6,000 watt bulbs. Can you imagine how expensive they are? No, I couldn't. And I knew, I can, that's the word he used, 6,000 watt bulb. I can remember that. It was huge. But I always missed. I mean, my dad didn't understand that I always missed. He should have. My brother Paul, he was an excellent athlete. I wasn't. So Dad went on. And at some point when we were still cleaning up, I don't remember if I thought about it. I certainly didn't do it in the face of my father's call. I did it, though. I did it. I picked a stone up, and I leaned back, and I winged it at one of those bulbs. And I tell you what, I mean, this is almost as in a holy manner. The moment that stone left my hand, I knew that for one horrible second, I was an athlete. I watched that stone go on a perfect, perfect path, straight up to that 6,000 watt. And the thing is, it was all, I mean, the whole world went slow. I watched it come up to that bulb and start curving there. It reached its apogee just underneath the bulb, just underneath the bulb. And it was as if that little stone had a foot. It came under the bulb, and because it didn't quite, the foot reached out and went kink. And the stone and this beautiful rain of crystal glass came all down on me. I'm swallowed. I come out of that trance and I whirl around my brother Paul. I said, don't you tell Dad anything. Randy and Feller and all the ones, I said, don't you tell Dad anything. They all heard my father. Yeah, no, no, swear. And they all swore. You know what I was doing in that moment? I was under the pew, back and down in the boiler room. I'm gonna hide this. So they swore, and I thought that I had it covered, and I went home. And I don't know how to tell you this, but that very same night, we are seven children at the table, and there's a lot of banter, and there's a lot of chit-chat, and there's a lot of talk, and Dad will sometimes ask about our day, and so he says, so how was your day, and what did you do? So I'm sitting there, you know, the oldest of seven, setting an example, and Dad says, what did you do? And I'm saying, play football. I'm not saying I broke that 6,000 watt. I'm thinking I broke that 6,000, but that's in here. I'm hiding that. I said, play football. You know, there was a moment. I don't even think I was aware of it, not then, but I know now. In that moment, I divided. I became the Wally on the outside and the Wally on the inside. I divided. Now, I looked at Paul, because at that point I didn't want him to say anything either, and he was doing fine. He just went on average and so forth. He knew, I knew, Dad didn't know. My father had a habit in those days, an affectionate habit, of calling me, he had called us all by sort of nicknames, and I'm not sure where they came from, but he called me Avi. Avi, he would say. Avi. Even when I was little, you know, and I had his whiskers on you know, your soft little cheek, which on the one hand you really like, and on the other hand you hate. Avi. But it's love. I mean, that's the association. And so, and in the nights to come after that, my father would say to me, Avi. And instead of that being an affection or a welcome unto me, you've got to understand, it hurt me. You do understand. It hurt me. Because he was saying untruth, and he didn't know it. My dad, who loved me, didn't know he was saying untruth. It's hell in that boiling room. And I didn't, I mean, it began to build over the time, and I began to feel as if there was a part of me that was not a part of the family, and it was mostly because they didn't know what I really was and what I had done. I was carrying this thing inside of me, except for Paul. And there came a point, there was an evening, my brother and I slept in the same bed, and Paul had this horrible habit of laughing at me with his teeth, with his tongue between his teeth. And I don't know what would cause him to laugh like that, but in those days, that laughter just felt hateful to me, like he was superior. I mean, like, he was superior morally to me, as well as athletically and everything else. And the trouble was, he was. I believed he was superior, and I hated his laugh even more. And so I had a habit with my brother. I would make a knuckle like this, and I would hit him right here, right on that bony part. And I remember that I did that. He started running from me, laughing, which is worse. Laughing is the horrible thing. He remembers to this day, he tells me he couldn't help it, but I thought he could help it. Laughing at me, and I came upon him, and I hit him on the shoulder, and he went down. Bam! He went straight down like that, and it was obvious pain to him. And then he said, he cursed me. He cursed me. He said, nobody likes you. That's honestly what he said. He said, nobody likes you, and he said, you don't even care that nobody likes you. Well, he was wrong. I mean, he was right. I thought nobody liked me. They couldn't like me because they didn't know the true me, because I'm a liar. I'm a deceiver. But he was wrong. I really cared. I mean, I really cared that nobody liked me or could like me. And now my dad would come and he'd sit on the side of the bed and he'd, you know, I'd rub my back and he'd say, Avi, and I'd burst into tears. His love was like a fire. It was horrible. Because I didn't deserve it, and therefore I didn't receive it. I didn't think I could, because he was saying it to his figment. He was saying it to the thing I should have been. He was saying it to what he thought I was, but I wasn't. Do you understand? Well, there came a time when, for me, that boiler room and that separation that I had created, that hell, was beginning to balance against what my father would do in genuine punishment when he found out I broke that 6,000 watt bulb. I mean, I could have been spanked. I had been spanked. I didn't want to be spanked. But you know, there came a time when spanking wasn't as bad as a whole world of this sort of isolation. And it got so strong that I said, okay, I'm going to tell Dad. And I left our house, which is on the property of Concordia, and no one knew, my mom still didn't know, and I went across the greensward, across this beautiful green grass to the administration building, the ad building, with his old brick and his long eyes, you know, had these lugubrious long eyes, the windows. Went in the front door and went down these, you know how they used to have high halls in those days, and for little kids it's double high, and I went to the door of the president. There it said, W.M. Wongren, president. Huge door. And on the way, my butt's swelling. It's tingling. My butt is tingling. Because it knows what's coming, you know? And it's talking to me. It's saying, you got us into this, but I have to get hit. It's like dragging my butt to my dad's office.
knocked on the door. It's like a little roach kick. Beep, beep, beep.
Yes? Someone was there. So I opened it up the door, and I walked in, and there sat my father. He always placed his desk between whoever was coming and his own seat. Not on the side, a desk. Judge's desk. Eternal life or death. Well, it was almost like that. And so I came in and I stood. He said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Dad, you know that 6,000 watt bulb?" "Yes." I said, "I threw a stone and I broke it." And he just sat there looking at me. And I'm doing all I can to remain human, not to burst into tears or run or anything. He got up from his desk and he came around, and I just stood still, and he came to the side of me and he knelt down on my left hand side. He knelt down so that his head came about my level, and he hugged me. He hugged me. And I don't know if I can explain to you the huge drama that took place in the few moments of that hug. The first, it was so horrible. I just burst into crying. I mean, I burst into tears. It was so bad that he would love me anyway. It was so hard that he would love me anyway. And so I cried. But I think the fact that I was crying and that he didn't pull away but hug me the tighter changed it all. Just changed it all. Because here I was. I mean, I was evident. I was living right there, out loud, boo-hooing snot and everything. And he hugged me tighter. So then the hell of love actually became the confluence of mercy for me. And it became transfigured. You follow? Oh, I had to pay for the bulb. Which was a kindness. It granted me the capacity, the ability to make atonement with whatever else was lost in that. I mean, the love empowered me to enact atonement, not to Dad, that was done, but to the college or whatever. Do you follow? This is the picture of hell that I think lurks behind this history. I had delivered something else. I would have delivered something else for the sake of my power. I wanted to maintain my power. I didn't want to be in trouble. Now, at that point, I was not a very powerful person. I was only just a little kid, and what I burned was truth. This, I think, finally, is where hell is. And if we want to ravel it into the hereafter as well as into the here, sorry, I won't be able to read Dostoevsky, but this is what he says. Father Zosima says in the Brothers Karamazov, "Fathers and Brothers, what is hell?" He said, "I maintain that hell is being unable to love." He says, "I maintain that hell is finally knowing what love is and not being able to love." And he means in the afterlife. He says that as long as we're in this life, we can love. We can make sacrifice not of our children, not of others, but of ourself. We can make sacrifice of ourself in loving. But once we have no life that can be given up anymore, because the life thereafter isn't ours to choose to give up. Once we have no self to give up for the sake of others, in this sweet, blessed paradox of being joyful even underneath burdens, of giving up things and receiving at the same time a sense of joy. Once he says we don't have that choice anymore, then we could be in heaven. It doesn't matter. We could be among the saints. We can even have God sally near us, but their capacity to love throws into violent contrast our incapacity to love, because now we don't have the choice anymore. That, he says, is hell. And I think I understand that. But I told you my story to say that there is a sense of the hell here, and it becomes one of these signs. There is a sense now when we may strive and sacrifice others to our desires, our abuses. And if we watch, the consequence is a horrible isolation. It's a terrible isolation. And the front that we give to other people will always be false. Now, we may delight in that if we think we are, you know, what was perhaps the central of all sins, that we want to place ourselves in the seat of God, that we want to reign, if you use that imagery, over a kingdom. What God finally says at the end of all things, what God says, is that your choice? You've turned everybody else to your will? Is that your choice? Your whims have become their commandments? Is that your choice? You want to choose what is good and evil for yourself and not what is good and evil for all the people? Is that your choice? Okay, God says, and that's all God says. I give it to you. I give you what you ask.
And so when there is no more choice anymore, we reign powerful kings of a kingdom that has but one citizen. Ourselves. And we can go ahead and try to love ourselves as much as possible, but in the midst of the shining of what true love is, that becomes its own hell, here and hereafter. Let me touch. This is some of Sally McFay's, but I find we're very much together at this. When human beings together, who ought to live in sweet harmony, in organic relationship to the planet, because we are granted that organic relationship, whatever creation story you use, we are granted an organic relationship to the planet. When we seize the planet for our own selves, we create a horrid isolation within the universe for ourselves. A desperate isolation. And all we can do is hit our chests the harder to make it seem glorious that we are no longer children of this universe, that we're destroying things around us. Do you see the con? So that's a hell here. That's why we rush the pleasure thing. Well, at least let me be happy in this little tiny room that I've created. Or the power thing. Well, at least let me bend others to my will. And then finally, I always remember Isaiah's irony. If the church arrogates to itself the power to choose what is only God's, what's right and wrong, and if the church thereby sacrifices people, their children, unto mock for their power, if the church becomes exclusive, and according to its designs says, this person is in, that one is out. Isaiah's irony says, you who are sending things through Moloch shall go through Moloch yourself. Watch out, O you Ephesian church. You say, these people can be a part of our church, those people can't. And look here, we're even going to legislate it. Watch out now. Doesn't mean just watch for the paradoxes. It says, watch out. This abuse of power has this, let me even read it, this profound irony. Isaiah 30, 33. I know, I should find another note to end on as soon as I read this. Here Isaiah is talking about the Assyrians, terror stricken, and every stroke of the staff of punishment that the Lord lays upon the Assyrian will be to the sound of timbrels and lyres battling with brandished arm. He will fight with him. Verse 33. For his burning place, that is to say, for the valley of Hinnom, has long been prepared. Truly it is made ready for the king, those who have burned their children there. Its pyre made deep and wide, with fire and wood in abundance, the breath of the Lord, like a stream of sulfur, kindles it. It's a horrible, ironic image, and it says, oh, you king, you burn your children. Don't you know that where you have to watch out is your own hands? The irony is, but you shall enter there. And, you know, and sometimes I find myself getting pink in the face, hot in the face, and passionate when I look at our church. But don't do that. I'm saying that to you, don't do that. Why am I saying that to you? Because I love you. Because I love what you may be. And I'm not talking to the body of Jesus right now. I'm talking to ecclesial powers. Don't do that. Oh, well, I think I have to end there. But we're not ending. We're going to gather again this afternoon and tomorrow. And it is now 10 after. But so there was a lot of goodness all the way through. My dad did hug me. Atonement, the confluence of the gods. All that is potential both now, here and hereafter. Oh, but what is, yeah, here, but what does it ask? It may ask this, it may ask this really horrible thing of us, the thing that John the Baptist asks. Repentance. Tears. And you understand, it isn't repentance like that's a punishment you have to undergo. No, no, no. You know what repentance is? It's this hidden self suddenly made evident and open. It's this deception suddenly lost. And those tears, now those are not the tears of the abused who finally are beginning to come to hell. Those are the tears of the abusers. They are the tears of those who have hidden themselves for fear and for sin, finally coming forward and being free. Those tears are repentance. Yeah, that's a good word. Repentance remains a powerful and blessed thing for us, which, until we do it, looks most scary. Because it's like the loss of self. Here's myself, I'm holding it in, I'm holding it in. Here's myself, I'm fainting it on. I don't want to cry, because if I repent and cry, all this, which I think is myself, oh, and I cry, and the arms that held me didn't let go. and the arms that held me, oh, you sinners, I'm talking to you not as the abused, but the abuser, and the arms that hold you, don't let go. And in a flash, that drama happens. Thanks.